I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein.
We're the hosts of Built for Change, a new podcast from Accenture.
The pandemic has radically transformed the way we do business.
And now is the time to forge a new path ahead. So what do the world's most innovative leaders think about navigating change? What strategies are working for them?
On Built for Change, we'll learn what Accenture has discovered about how businesses can rise to these challenges and find success.
Subscribe to Built for Change now so you don't miss an episode.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your lean all in my bladder of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. If I could play for you the sound of Lil Nas X tweeting, that's what I would play. I can't play that. So that was Montero, Call Me By Your Name, which is the most recent big single from Lil Nas X. Lil Nas X is having a very big year. There's an album coming, ostensibly, but really Lil Nas X is a child of the internet, a creature of the internet, and a champion of the internet. Montero is a very big single. I've written about it twice already. Once because of how Lil Nas X handled all the internet blowback to the video. And the video is salacious, but good-natured and funny. And yet, of course, received a lot of predictable conservative blowback. That's one thing. And also because there are multiple different YouTube versions, system gaming versions of Montero, Call Me By Your Name, to extend the life of the single, which is something that I wrote about kind of hand in hand with the Spot 'em, Got 'em, Beatbox, Beatbox 2, Beatbox 3, et cetera, et cetera. So Lil Nas X already out in front this year. We're going to talk this week with Jasmine Hughes, who wrote the cover story for the Times Magazine about Lil Nas X that came out last week. Later, at the end of the show, stick around because I want to share a little bit of wholesome storytelling about a recent trip I took. But first, there's only one person I know who has spent time with Montero the man, Jasmine Hughes. Jasmine, hello, welcome to Popcast.
Well, it's Gucci Caramonica. Hi, it's really nice to be here.
Jasmine is a reporter on Metro, a staff writer at the magazine, wrote the cover story on Lil Nas X that came out last week. Jasmine, before we get into the specifics of your time with him and all the kind of good, juicy stuff in the story, let's kind of take it back a little bit. Let's rewind the clock. When Lil Nas X arrives into the pop music ecosystem, off of the strength of the Old Town Road viral TikTok, what was he like as a person at that time? Because we kind of know what Lil Nas X has matured into. Based on your conversations with him, what was he like back then? What was the starting point?
When Old Town Road first popped off, Nas was 19, right? And he had just spent...
My age.
Yeah. He was the age that I'm going to be next year.
Wow.
But he had just spent all this time, like, hiding out in Nicki Minaj, like, forums, right? He was a barb. And I am reluctant to say was a barb because it does sort of seem like an organization that you have to, like, kill or die to get out of.
Yeah, but blood oath. There's definitely blood oath, yeah.
Truly. Which is to say he had spent... essentially every waking hour of most of his teenage years on the internet. And so, like, there's this now apocryphal story that he is this, like, genius kid who had this incredible, like, mind that's sort of like Google Analytics and, like, knew what would pop off on the internet. And, I mean, he told me this, and I took it sort of with a grain of salt, but it kind of seems true just because he was online, based on our conversations, like, 16, 17, 18 hours a day, every single day.
Right. It's like the difference between me and Joe Coscarelli, for example.
Right. Joe's a clandestino.
Yeah.
You're on IG. Tomato, tomato.
Woo. So a digital native in like the truest sense, and also someone seeking to find identity and community on the internet.
But because he was finding identity and community on the internet in 2016, 2017, that identity and community was predicated on attacking other people on the internet, right? So he was a real asshole. And there are many, many Twitter threads, I don't need to direct anyone to them, that outline the sins that we all might have made if every single move we ever made or like thought or joke we made when we were 15, 17 years old was captured on the internet in perpetuity.
I am a perfect angel baby. I don't know what you're talking about. A perfect angel baby.
I am only 19 years old myself, so I've never made an error in my life.
So starting from that perspective, right, there are plenty of people who go through that arc of internet obsession, internet addiction, and never really come out the other side. That becomes the kind of entire framework of their personality. But he has this incredible good fortune. He makes a song, the song goes viral, and then obviously becomes the phenomenon that we all now understand. Let's play just a flicker of Old Town Road in case you don't have it playing in your head constantly.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached, head is matted black, got the bushes black to match, riding on a horse, ha.
Old Town Road is such a singular phenomenon that it runs the risk of being fundamentally unrepeatable. Even on the best possible day, it would be nigh impossible to repeat what happened with Old Town Road. And the annals of pop music history are littered with the carcasses of people who had one spectacular breakout moment and not a second. Based on your conversations with him, how did he set about to not become a casualty of that?
To sit down and research the song, it is sort of incomprehensible how freaking enormous it was. Like, it spent more time at number one than the Macarena did. More than I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston. Like, Taylor Swift could not knock it out. Justin Bieber and Ed Sheeran together could knock it out. It was like a force unto itself. And it was kind of an accident. Like, it was an intentional song, but he wasn't, you know, a super producing team who like had the algorithm to sort of gain the greatest song of all time. So I think that he did what everybody would do after that, which is that he got really psyched out. And I spoke to his producing team, Take a Day Trip, and they told me about like how frustrating it was for him that he couldn't immediately, sort of like he'd unintentionally done before, made a world shattering song after like, you know, fooling around for 15 minutes on his computer. So he, after Old Town Road, he released this very short EP and he would go out on tour with it. And like, nobody knew the 8 other songs in the EP, right? So he was depressed because he was out. No one knew his songs. He was trying to write more songs, but none of them were popping off. And so I think he told me, and I didn't put this into the story, but he was like, the pandemic was the best thing to ever happen to me, which again, when I was 22, I was not speaking to a New York Times reporter. But by that, he meant like he really got an additional year to recalibrate and to sort of like fail a bunch of times and throw these tantrums and come to terms with the idea that no one, like not only could he not beat Old Town Road, no one will ever do it. So what's another goal he could set for himself and how could he reach that?
That's the healthiest way to approach a problem like that. And I have memory of in the immediate aftermath of Old Town Road, and maybe even before the release of the EP. I mean, there are things that I know that I can't speak on, but I just know that there were some challenges in getting Lil Nas X, the person and public-facing entity, up to speed with Old Town Road, the song. Because the song was moving very fast and going very far. And here's a kid who, you know, 3 months before was like literally living at home. And you can't just wake up one morning and be a super duper celebrity who is out on camera all the time. It just doesn't work like that. And I know that there was an adjustment period for sure.
Oh, for sure. I mean, 3 months prior, he wasn't even at home. He was like sleeping on his sister's couch and like had just quit his job. I mean, and the undercurrent to all of this, which he now talks about openly, is that he was gay and he was really closeted and he didn't want anyone to know he was gay. And I talked a little bit about like suddenly overnight being one of the biggest celebrities in the entire world, or, you know, having the biggest song in the entire world and being in front of millions and billions of eyes, but also having this like enormous secret. At the same time as being 19, at the same time as like going on a private jet for the first time, which is also only your second time on an airplane ever, and just all the cacophony that his wife started to resemble.
He had initially denied being an active Barb, a TweetDecker. And one of the things he talked to you about was he didn't want people to think that he was gay. But in admitting that, he thought people would assume that he was gay.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I think he ended up insulting Nicki Minaj a tiny bit in that eschewing. But absolutely. I mean, he later came out and tweeted, like, how many straight men in hip hop do you know who spent 4 years defending Nicki Minaj on the internet every day? Like, the proof is in the pudding, right? And so, I mean, everybody on the internet was like, dude, I remember your viral tweets from 6 months ago. And he had to do this whole performance of like, what? No, that wasn't me. And, you know, I think he took a little bit of that mythology and folded into the story of his viral success. Like, he talked to Joe a lot about this in this Diary of a Song. But it took him more time to really embrace his previous identity as a Barb.
You were able to spend some time with him as he's putting songs together for what I presume will be the first full-length album. I have a little bit of a side theory that I actually don't think he needs to put out a full-length album. You know, I think if anything, he's a great singles artist, and, you know, the pressure of an album is maybe not even necessary in 2021 for an artist who works the way that he works. That's a sidebar. But you were able to spend some time with him as he's putting songs together. Talk to me a little bit about his state of mind. Tell me about what it was like to spend time with him, what it was like to hear his approach to music.
Now I'm chewing on this album idea. I mean,
I really think it's not necessary. Like dead ass. I just don't think, I think, and I mean that not specifically only for him. I mean that even more broadly. I think if you're Adele, you put an album out, right? You keep people waiting for 5 years and then you drop a body of work. But I think if you're someone who is completely internet native and whose mode of communication is super frequent, super online, it's much better to drip out content kind of over and over and over again. I think if you drip out content, that's more meaningful to a young fan and to an internet-enabled fan than, hey, I did a 14-song album. That's just going to come and go, you know?
So one thing I think that's interesting or that has been surprising to me about Nas's album is that he, and this could happen for singles too, but he managed to get like every freaking producer in the book to work with him on this. Although what I will say in response to that, John, is that I think that you are adequately, or rather like appropriately reading Nas's placement in the music scene. I think he like is really at a time where he desperately wants to be taken seriously as a true artiste, right? And so he like wants to present this cohesive body of work in response in major part to this idea that he is this one-hit wonder, right? So this is like, at one point I asked him, how much of your life is about proving other people wrong? And he said, almost all of it. Like, I wish I was a 22-year-old, like, rich, successful, incredibly well-adjusted person living in Los Angeles, right? He seems incredibly happy. And the difference between him as himself and most other 22-year-old, like, rich, good, successful rap stars is that he is, like, mostly been okay. There's been very little controversy around him, you know, like, knock on wood. So he's got people keeping him put together. I was very impressed that he seems to have good people in his corner keeping him grounded. And I think, if anything, that was probably more of a secret to his intended longevity than most other things. But with regard to this album itself, like, he really wants to be taken seriously. He really, I think, is working on his voice as an instrument. I mean, we are all incredibly familiar with his mind and his cleverness and stuff, but he's really trying to sing.
Yeah, let's talk about that. One of the people you spoke to for your piece was the homie Kook Harrell. And for those who don't know, Kook Harrell is a vocal coach who I profiled about 10 years ago when he was working with Justin Bieber, Rihanna, Jennifer Lopez, so on and so forth. And what Kook does is basically extract the peak vocal performances out of the clients that he works with. And that can be through a combination of technology, through psychology. There's a lot of tools that go into that. Tell me a little bit about Lil Nas X finding his voice and what you and Kook talked about in that regard.
Kook and I talked about you first and foremost. He was like, yo, you know John Caramanica?
Okay.
He's like, I love that guy.
So
thank you to you, because I came in a little more trusted because I had good people in my corner. So shout out to you. Kook was, you know, because I'm a journalist for the New York Times, he was like, Nas is the next big thing. He's so unique. He's such a rare talent. There's no one like him in the game. And so we were trying to think of who is the last incredibly successful Black male vocalist. So not like Drake, like a rapper. I mean, kind of Chris Brown without all the other Chris Brown things.
Without the baggage. Yeah.
Without all the baggage. And Drake is also Canadian, as is The Weeknd, who is probably the closest answer to someone we have working today. But Kook's whole point was that Nas is occupying the space of Black male vocalists in the pop space, as opposed to R&B that we haven't seen in a really long time. And that is why Kook was so attracted to working with him. And so we spent this day in the studio and Nas comes in and it was, you know, like almost like watching what I assume a diva does before her concert. Like he drank his throat coat. Like he did a little moving around to get the body warm. He was like in the studio, like, you know, like really vibing, having these really soulful like moves within himself. And Kook was loving it. Kook was like, that's amazing. That's incredible. That like, I love that. Give me more of that. Like, I almost wish, you know, when I was writing down the story, my editor would come over to me every three sentences, be like, it's brilliant. Oh my God, I love that. Oh, this is going to be so good. You know, I need that in my life.
Watching Kook work, it was very, very, like, I totally agree with you. It's like, you're like, damn, I wish someone would do that for me while I'm writing, you know? Like, yo, you killed that sentence. Yo, just one more. Yo, one more sentence. No, just like that one. Just one more. You can do it. You know, it's very, and I would, but I would also imagine for someone like Nas, right, who is still, I would say, unproven, still finding footing, to have someone who is that nurturing and that encouraging in his corner, that's got to be a key part of him being able to feel secure in what he's putting out now.
Absolutely. And I mean, I also spent maybe too much of this time of my time with him thinking about his age, but like 22 is the worst, weirdest time where you think you're all grown up and you know a bunch of shit about your life, but you absolutely know nothing. And sometimes even less than you did when you were 16, 17 years old. Right. And so I think that it really behooves him to have all the support in his corner because he's probably a little less grounded than he might think he is.
Let's listen to a little bit of another recent song. It's called Sun Goes Down, where he gets into some of his emotional state of mind.
You need an instant ease from your life where you got plenty of every hurt and heartbreak. You just take it all to the face. I know that you want to cry, but it's much more to life than dying.
He's in this interesting position of being well-adjusted and confident, but also still kind of feeling out who he's going to become in public life. In part, coming out gives him a confidence and a clarity and also increasingly a purpose in terms of his presentation in pop. We still don't see very many openly gay pop stars of any gender, frankly. How much did you guys talk about that and the responsibilities or burdens associated with that?
We talked less about this directly, and we talked more about like the more visual or perhaps ostentatious part of his gay identity, right? Which is that like he can sometimes like dress in more feminine style clothing, or he like will wear quote unquote masculine clothing, but he'll like have his nails painted and he'll have eyelashes on or eyeshadow on or what have you. And so we talked about what he termed as shape-shifting. This is mostly pegged around a conversation that we had in which he and I discussed him dressing up like Nicki Minaj for Halloween a couple of years ago, like replete with like the falsetto breasts, and he wore like a corset and he had the, you know, he had the lashes and he had the wig and all this stuff. And people like 50 Cent lost their damn minds on Twitter, right? Like, and so we talked about the responses that he's gotten, particularly from people in the hip hop community, right? Since when Old Town Road came out, it was a trap hip hop song. And I think in the attempts to sort of like remove it from a country lineage and take it off of the country charts, people are like, this is a rap song, even though it really wasn't.
That's actually something that I think really went under discussed in that entire like 1.0 phase of Old Town Road, which is, I think that Old Town Road had way more in common with contemporary country than in potentially with contemporary hip hop. But that was something that people just couldn't get their heads around because of who was doing the song. And because the discourse, it was a much easier discourse to say, ah, here's a young black guy making a country trap song that's getting excluded from country music. That's a very easy narrative, and also a narrative that his record label pushed very aggressively to help give shape to those early weeks. But also, Old Town Road was not a total fit in hip hop, even though it's an inheritor of a lot of the stuff that's been happening over the last 5 years. I wouldn't say it was a clean fit. And I don't think that a lot of the stuff that he's done subsequent to that is necessarily a clean fit for what we think of as contemporary hip hop.
No. And in this song that he's been teasing all week, his next single, which is a song called Industry Baby.
With Jack Harlow,
and it's produced by Daytrip and Kanye. I mean, he really, I think for the first time that I'm aware of, like, embraces this pop label really, really readily. If you're going to compare yourself to Justin Bieber, you're like incredibly comfortable being deeply situated in the midst of pop. And, you know, sort of like side-eyeing, like nudge, like, I'm going to be an incredible success like Justin Bieber too. I'm not even trying to pretend like I'm going to be a rapper anymore, right? And so you're right that when Old Town Road came out, he was very, very adamant that he had made a country song. And one of the things that Kook and I talked about is that Nas embraces so many genres that he doesn't feel a need to commit to anything, which means that he's a pop star, which is what all pop stars do.
Let's actually listen to a little bit of Industry Baby, and then we'll be back in a second after that.
Baby, bet, ay, couple X, ay, couple Grammys on him.
Bladen County, North Carolina, made national headlines in 2018 when a congressional race was thrown out due to election fraud. The story behind that election is actually a story of a series of election fights fueled by personal grudges, petty beefs, family history, and history. And it's about the oldest fight of all, the fight for the black vote. I'm Zoe Chase, host of the Improvement Association from the makers of Serial and the New York Times. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
To pick up on the idea about pop actually being all-inclusive of all these other genres, that is, certainly in 2021, we're in the Drake pop era, post-Drake pop era, where singing and rapping coexist, where pop and hip-hop coexist, hip-hop and R&B, of every other genre and hip-hop all coexisting at the same time. In your mind, based on your conversations with him, that's the kind of pop star that Lil Nas X imagines himself becoming.
Absolutely. I mean, Drake and Nicki Minaj, I think, are his North Stars in the sky, right? Like, he loves Nicki for the ways that, you know, that gay men love divas, right? Like, some people like Cher, some people like Whitney Houston. Nas loves Nicki Minaj. But with regard to Drake's career specifically, and that can mean, like, presenting this laundry list of the albums and mixtapes and EPs and stuff that Drake has had, and also just being, working with a wide variety of people and being, you know, begrudgingly respected eventually as a lyricist and as a performer, that is what Nas is trying to do.
Why do you get the sense that that's important to him? Is it purely to prove doubters wrong? Is it for his own kind of like artistic fulfillment? You know, you said earlier on that you asked him what percent of his life is given over to proving people wrong, and he said most of it. Does he want to be an artist because people think he's not an artist? Is that really the motivation?
So my answer to this is going to be based not on my reporting, but on, you know, on like the 7 years of psychotherapy I've done for myself, right? So
great.
With that caveat,
I will respond to it with the, you know, decade plus of therapy that I have. So let's go. Let's go down
that's
this road.
That's a lot of therapy for a 19-year-old, John.
I started young with a lot of things.
I think that Nas, again, really wants to prove himself. I think that, I mean, he told me, like, so the times in our conversations in which he got the most impassioned, the most emotional, like the times in which his eyes most lit up was one, when I said, why is Nicki Minaj your favorite rapper? And two, when he described to me the first time he was like messing around in GarageBand or what have you and put together a track and it really all clicked together for him. I mean, this is a kid who like grew up pretty poor, like was shuttled back and forth between his parents in a custody battle. His mother, unfortunately, suffers from addiction issues. His grandmother died. And so, like, I think he had a really good childhood, but a pretty disruptive one. And the fact that he stumbled upon something in his youth at, you know, 17, 18 years old, in which he made this song and it made him feel really good. I think he truly feels as if he found his purpose. And the fact that his purpose also sort of like gets at that one of the very things that drew him to Nicki Minaj, this sort of like defiance and this like this sort of light, constant trolling that is like, oh, whatever expectation you have of me, I'm going to subvert it. That comes with, you know, being a Barb, having those two things together in, you know, this performance of him as Lil Nas X is, I think, is everything he's been looking for.
What if I theorized that the medium that Lil Nas X is truly a virtuoso in is not music, but rather the art of interneting, that that is his raison d'etre, broadly speaking? How do you feel about that?
Zen and the Art of Tweeting. That's going to be his first book, I hope. Yeah, he's brilliant at that. Who's better?
Nobody's better. And it's important to understand, because I think we spend a lot of time, certainly over on our side of the New York Times pop music coverage, we spend a lot of time thinking about and writing about how artists use the internet to further their goals, how artists are used by the internet, often to their detriment. But there is no person who feels more authoritative online in the entire pop, hip-hop, any genre space than Lil Nas X. Here is someone who seems to be fearless when dealing with provocateurs or trolls. He can troll right back. Sometimes he trolls back with trollery. Sometimes he trolls back with profound sincerity, which is totally disarming. He doesn't distinguish between insults from famous people and insults from randos. He just kind of comes with the howitzer regardless. And it's deeply inspiring to watch, especially as a person who has kind of like retreated from the internet over the years, because I'm just like, I just don't want to discourse every day. You know what I mean? He seems like someone who maybe genuinely thrills to the discourse. It comes off effortless. It comes off as a thrill. Do you get the sense that he actually feels that way? Or is it onerous? Is it weighing on him? How did he talk about his internet responsibilities? Forget his music responsibilities.
Oh, it absolutely weighs on him. When the Times, you know, I got like the kiss of death, which is when like the New York Times main account retweets your story. And then you get all these crazy people being like, yes, Trump is back. It's the worst, right?
First of all, I want to thank everybody in our social team for tweeting my stories. And please don't stop tweeting my stories. That said, the distinction between when my stories go out on NY Times Music versus when they go out on NY Times couldn't be more stark.
Totally different world. And you're right. Shout out to the social team. Couldn't do without you. I hope that you're well compensated. If not, contact me as your guild representative. However.
Oh, wow. I didn't know we were unioning on this
we're
podcast.
We're in bargaining session right now, John.
Okay. Email Jasmine at her personal account.
And then we can talk. I want to make sure you're taken care of. But so I bring up the Times tweeting out the Nas story because I got a bunch of Looney Tunes in my mentions, which never ever happens to me as someone who just like tweets about being a single person eating cheese. And it gave me for 48 hours just a sneak preview into what Nas's mentions must look like. Now, Lil Nas X performed at the BET Awards. He did this homage to Michael Jackson's Remember the Time music video. And I want to say at the end he kissed a man, but like he had a juicy, like lip-sucking makeout with another dude on stage at the BET Awards, which I think we can safely say is among the most like conservative award ceremonies. It's like the one where my mom, who like loves me and like understands that I'm a lesbian, but doesn't like really understand why I won't have sex with Michael B. Jordan. Like that is who's watching the BET Awards, right? And so when my story goes up, my mentions are filled with the most like odious, hateful, like, you know, there's stuff that's like, haha, funny, like, oh, I'm going to discount this person, or like, oh, maybe this person is like mentally ill and working their shit out on the internet. But like, these are people who were, you know, sending me pictures or, you know, responding to the tweet with pictures of Nas with his skin lightened and his nose made smaller, right? And they were like countless references to buck breaking, which is a practice that dates back to the time of slavery, in which enslaved men were raped by their slave owners in order to sort of force them into submission. There are lots of people talking about the conspiracy to feminize or emasculate the Black man. A lot of people saying that, like, Black women have joined together with white women in order to take down all men. Just, like, really, really messed up stuff that I saw that people were, you know, were only saying to the New York Times that, which in the tweet only said, like, we have a story about Lil Nas X. So I can only imagine the responses that he gets on a daily basis. And, you know, and I write a little bit about, like, him fighting with trolls and homophobes following the BET Awards. And one thing that was surprising to me and seemed to garner one of the rare, really earnest responses was criticism from other Black gay men who were essentially like, you're embarrassing, you're over the top, like, it's already so hard for us. Like, why are you heightening the performance of homosexuality as opposed to just like showing up to the BET Awards in a suit and like going home and having sex with men in private, right? And so what's difficult for Nas is that in many cases, I think that he gets it from everyone. Like, you know, obviously at the end of the day, he has legions of fans. He has this like strong core team around him. He has a lot of money, which helps, right? But I think that every time he opens up his phone, it is just a deluge of sewer poop bullshit.
In its ideal form, I believe celebrity is an expression of loving oneself. If you can really truly be yourself at a high level, I think that goes in hand with being a really good celebrity. And that is what I see in him. And that is what I see in a person who's swatting down trolls. And that is what I see in a person who's having a performance like that on the BET Awards. How hard was it for him to gain, earn, hold on to that self-love?
I think that gaining, earning, and having that self-love really helps when you live in Los Angeles, right? Because you can, like, go for hikes, and, like, everybody's meditating, and, like, everyone is burning incense all the time. What I will say is that I think that he took the pandemic and got really spiritual. So I think, you know, when I was 21, I, like, over Christmas, winter break from college, I read, like, the autobiography of Malcolm X or something, right? Whereas Nas is reading these books about spirituality, finding yourself, being the best person you can be. He's reading a lot of self-help books. And I think that, like, you know, as a child, he's a really good student. He's a person who really enjoyed school. And so I can imagine this, like, period of, you know, this didactic education of self-love is actually really gratifying for him. But I also think that it's a process, right? He was much more willing to talk to me about the self-help books and about, like, inner strength and about the peace that he's found than really revealing any sadness. Only my reporting from talking to people in his team, like talking to the, you know, the older Black woman who spent time with him and talking to the producers and talking to the people who he ostensibly talks to about this, did I really get a sense that it affects him in any way. But to me, he did not reveal any of this.
Always a challenge when you're profiling someone, especially at this kind of phase of celebrity where there's this instinct to always show the good side, the ups, you know, we're on the upswing, everything is going in the right direction. But of course, that's not always the case. But I will say from a public presentation perspective, he carries whatever it is, whether it's a burden or it's not a burden, he carries it incredibly well. Every time I go on the internet, I feel like someone is apologizing for something they did, some celebrity. It's like, I did this thing, and it's like a constant cycle. And I think what I kind of really admire about how he handles internet fame is, I don't want to say it's unapologetic, which is to say it's unthinking, but it's engaged, it's living, it's evolutionary, and it's also, it meets the internet on its own terms and then kind of like gives it the middle finger a little bit.
And it's because I agree with you completely. And it's because he's, you know, part of a generation of pop stars. I think we could say a lot of the same things about Doja Cat, for example, right? Who were really like, for what's that Bane line? Like, you, I was like, I was molded by this. I was brought up in this. Like, Nas really grew up in this way. And, you know, weirdly, I kept thinking about Ava DuVernay and how she like worked as a publicist for a really freaking long time. And now, like, even though she's a director, she's still got that publicist muscle that she's working and able to direct and also make sure that her movie is in your face every time you leave your house. Nas is a little bit like that. He knows how to make things go viral. Now he's making the content himself as opposed to like stealing it from Google Images and like slapping on a fake caption. But he also knows how to game the system in really trolly ways and, to your point, in pretty earnest and profound ways as well.
You know, I feel like there's probably like a purist strain of pop music thinker that's like, that's not part of the game. But to me, like, that is the game. Certainly in 2021 and beyond, like, that's how you're effective. Actually, last week's episode of the show was about Doja and Tyler and basically being like trolls growing up and kind of like utilizing the skills of trollery to end up becoming pop music mainstays. I think in the future, we're going to see a lot of pop stars who really had a start as online enthusiasts, if we're going to be polite about it. I think we're going to see a lot of people who, you know, grew up speaking fluent internet for better and worse, and then applied those tools to something like pop music. That's how it feels.
Do you think it'll just be pop stars? I also wonder if it will
be
managers and publicists too. Like, you need a team of people who know how to make shit pop off.
I mean, in a weird way, I sort of wonder if Lil Nas X is actually more adept at all this than even the people he works with. Because theoretically, you usually expect the famous person to be the least adept, and everybody else is like, no, 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 this is what you do on the internet. No, 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 this is what you do. I kind of think low-key he's the most adept, and he's telling everybody else what to do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Daytrip told me that they were, like, working on a tweet about a collab they were doing, and they, like, showed Nas the tweet before they sent it off, and he, like, took the phone out of their hands and was like...
Right, he was like, no, no,
decapitalize this, don't put a period here, that's corny, like, put everything in lowercase. Exactly.
Lil Nas X is the Grammarly of meme tweeting.
He's the copy chief of the music industry.
That's true. Please don't fire any more copy chiefs. We need all the copy help we can get. Jasmine, what a joy to have you on to talk about Lil Nas X. I hope you have an incredible rest of the summer.
Thank you, John. I will see you on the internet every, I think you're there, every 4 to 6 weeks. So
yes,
I'll catch you in 6 weeks on one tweet. I'll save it so you know that I saw you.
Thank you.
Bye. Hey, it's a holiday. I got foes on foes and they out of control,
yo. Hey, this another way. All my hit doesn't go. So at the beginning, I promised a little bit of wholesome storytelling. So here is some wholesome storytelling for you. I was in Minneapolis recently for a quick trip. I took a little jaunt to the Mall of America. If you know me, you know I love malls. And as you do when you are in a city that is not your own and you want to see what the kids are vibing to, you go to the Hot Topic, right? You go to Hot Topic. So I'm there. I'm at the Hot Topic. I'm killing an hour or two. I'm looking at the shirts. There's a Linda shirt, which is hilarious. And I am texting Karen about, does she want one? And a couple of guys walk up to me and one of them asks me if he basically seems to recognize me. And we start talking. And it turns out that he listens to the show and him and his friend make music. The names are Nijay and Jason. Their groups, it's Jason's, Jason Banks. Nijay is a group called Plain Void. We were talking about pop punk and hip hop in Minneapolis. And it was really, really good to meet them. And I thought it was hilarious that all the places where you could pull up on me, I was in a Mall of America Hot Topic and still someone found me when I try to be super incog. Also, another funny thing that happened at the same Hot Topic, we mentioned Jack Harlow earlier in the show. This may not come as a surprise to you, but Jack Harlow t-shirts were not a big seller at the Hot Topic. In the discount rack, there were like 50 Jack Harlow t-shirts. I didn't even know that there were Jack Harlow t-shirts at Hot Topic. And this is not to malign Jack Harlow, who I think is fine and good, but he was not moving units at the Hot Topic. And I was talking to the clerk and I was sort of like looking at the big rack and I was like, huh, no one really messing with the Jack Harlow shirts, huh? And she's like, no. And she's like, I really want one though. And I was like, oh, you know, how come you don't get one? And, you know, she said she was working to, you know, help her family. And, you know, we're talking about the t-shirts and working at Hot Topic. And so at the end, before I walked out, I bought a Jack Harlow t-shirt and I bought her a Jack Harlow t-shirt. I think her name is Frankie. And so Frankie at Hot Topic at the Mall of America in Minneapolis, if you're hearing this, I hope that your tomorrow was better than that day, and things are only going to go up from here. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com or get on the Facebook group or the Discord. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple, Google Play, whatever. Our producer, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's actually go out with the Mason Ramsey and Young Thug version of Old Town Road.
Can't nobody tell me nothing.
Tell me nothing.